Hi, this is Scott Dixon, and you need more front wing.
Hello and welcome to another More Front Wing podcast. I'm Steph Wolcraft, and Paul Dalby is still away this week, recovering from his trip to Korea. So we have sitting in his place Bash Beard, a More Front Wing correspondent. And we're also joined this week by the IndyCar reporter for the Indianapolis Star and co-host of Trackside on 1070 The Fan, Kurt Cavan. Kurt, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Good to be with you, ladies.
So, Kurt, you were actually in Iowa this past weekend, of course. Can you give us a sense of how things looked compared to previous years and compared to some of the other events that you've been to this season? Let's not talk about Milwaukee.
Well, I thought Milwaukee was a pretty interesting race. I thought Iowa was kind of the best combination of activity on the track, fan reaction off it. The night racing is just exceptionally cool, and you know, being a Central Indiana guy, I'm kind of an oval track fan, so that was good to see from my perspective. I understand that not everybody feels that way, but I certainly enjoy a good oval track race, and I think it was good for the series and Andretti Autosport to have Marco win a competitive race. I don't know that TV numbers were still where they want them, but it was pretty entertaining on all fronts.
Absolutely. Would you say it's fair to estimate that this is probably second to Indy in terms of success of the oval events so far, and even in the last little while?
Did you say ovals?
Yes.
Yeah, I'd say this was, this was just good fun. I don't know how else to put it. I enjoyed Texas, although Texas didn't have as good a crowd as it's had in years past. Milwaukee, you know, we kind of alluded to, it was a struggle at the turnstile, but, you know, I think you'd have to put this oval track race up with any of them that there's been the last couple years. I don't know if it was necessarily better, but it was good on all fronts. I'd give it a good A minus on just about every front, and probably just a little higher for the action itself and the competitiveness. Although Dario led 172 of 250 laps, so it seems silly to say it was ultra-competitive, but it really was.
It absolutely was. That's a good segue into talking about the winner of the race, of course, being a big story out of the weekend is seeing Marco Andretti winning for the first time in 5 years. Here's a question for both of you, and we'll let Kurt answer first because he's the guest, but you have to answer this one honestly. Did you really think that Marco had it in him, or did you think that he might have been in the series along for the ride because of his name?
Well, I guess I would point out how young he still is.
Mm-hmm.
I think we've judged him a little unfairly because we expect him to be Michael Andretti, or we expect him to be his grandfather, or even his great uncle. This is a tough series right now, and I think we all have asked too much of him. You know, he's just 24 years old. J.R. Hildebrand, for example, roughly the same age, and we don't have those kind of expectations for him at his age. We think of him as being a young race car driver. Well, Marco has just been a young race driver for such a long time, that I think that's a little bit unfair. Now, you know, did I think he might have, fared a little better? Yeah, you probably would have thought he would have got to victory lane at some point, as you were asking me that question, grabbing the media guy to see how many times he's finished second in a race, you're no slouch when you do that. He just hadn't won races. I'll have that probably after Bash answers, but I'll look that up and give you some perspective after she throws her thoughts in.
Okay.
Yeah, I kind of tend to agree with that. I mean, there's so much pressure that comes with that name. And, I mean, I think we really kind of also want Marco to be in the forefront a little bit more because it's a name that the broader public can relate to versus Tagliani, who we all seem to really like, but they don't know who he is. And I think you see the name Andretti and you want him to do well, and for the exposure of the sport, you want to see Marco do well. And, you know, I agree also that, you know, he's still very young, and it seems like we've seen so many times in the past few seasons that, you know, his team has had a hard time qualifying well. And so they've always been kind of up against it. You add that to the competitiveness of the series, and it is going to be tough to win races. But he was talking about how Iowa is really a handling track, and it's not as much about the speed. And in that way, it seems like it's something that plays into Andretti's hands a little bit better, the team. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm going to be perfectly honest with you. I was one of the people that was questioning whether he belonged at the top level of IndyCar, realizing that he is very young, started very, very young. But I was one of the people who thought maybe his first win was a fluke and that maybe he was going to be a mid-packer for the majority of his career. And he's proven me wrong, and I'm very, very glad to see that because, as you said, it is important for him to be performing well. I can tell you that my dad sat down on Father's Day to watch part of the Milwaukee race with me, and he, of all the people that all the racers that they talked about, Marco was the one that he picked out and said, "Did they just say Marco Andretti?" So there's definitely a recognition factor there, particularly with people who haven't watched for a little while. So seeing Marco do well can attract some attention for sure.
Yeah, let me give you some numbers that I whipped up here. In his 91 starts, he's had 10 finishes of third or better, and he has led 26 of those 91 races. So you're looking at about 30% of the races he's led. The other thing that we can make these numbers in most cases say whatever we'd like them to say, but I think the one thing that kind of gets overlooked also is there's no shame in being sixth through about 12th in this sport.
That's true.
We criticize Danica a lot for, oh, she's not one of the best five drivers in this sport, and Marco would fall into that category too. But there's no shame in being sixth or seventh or eighth or anywhere, you know, up until probably 12th or 14th in this series.
No, it's very true, especially given how competitive the entire field is right now and the fact that Andretti Autosport has definitely had its ups and downs for the past, let's say, 3 or 4 years, which is a good way to work into my next question that I have for both of you. It just so happens that Andretti Autosport's two wins in the last two seasons, counting this one, have come at Long Beach and Iowa. Is it coincidence that they happen to do well at those two tracks and we don't really expect to see them do well anywhere else, or is Michael right and are they really back?
I think it's too early to say that they're back, but they have certainly shown very well at Iowa, and they've... You know, every team has a track or two that it's better at than others. Even Team Penske and Ganassi have their places where they're particularly strong at. This team won two races last year. We weren't saying they were back after two, so I'm not ready to say they're back after two this season.
Yeah, I'm kind of with you on that one. I mean, I don't know that they've really shown us that they've solved their qualifying problems. And again, that's, you know, as competitive as it is, I think that's a big deal. But I don't know if, you know, Michael's success at Long Beach kind of helps him out there because he has so much knowledge. That might be something. But, I'm wanting to wait and see on that as well.
Definitely interested to see how things go at New Hampshire this year with the way that the short ovals have been going for the rest of this season as well, and whether Andretti has some data now that they're able to use there to see some success there as well.
By the way, I did some other quick calculations as you two ladies were chatting. At best, I would say Marco is probably the ninth best driver in the series right now. If you take the two at Ganassi, the two best two at Ganassi, the three at Penske, Kanaan, like the sound of that, Bash, little bells in the background.
The cable car.
Yep. Kanaan, Wilson, and I had another, and Servia, I think you would say are consistently better than Marco on a regular basis. So he's at best ninth, and there's no shame in that.
No, that's top third of the field. So.
Yeah, we can't all be the first place driver. That's the thing. And if you look at who's in there right now, we're looking at, somebody who's probably going to end up being called a legend in Dario down the road because of his performance. So it's kind of tough to be, you know, that guy right now because there's a lot of them.
Well, and that's the thing is that I think what we're seeing right now is Dario really in the renaissance of his career and the two teams that are performing so much better not so much better, but consistently, significantly better than the rest of the field. People are just tired of seeing the same winners over and over again. It's a shame because in one way, it's like any sport having its eras, right? You have the eras of the Chicago Bulls and the New York Yankees, and right now we're seeing the era of the Penske's and the Ganassi's and Dario Franchitti and Will Power. And every sport's going to have those kinds of times of dominance, and auto racing is no exception. But for some reason, people are just really, and maybe it's because IndyCar is in a growth period right now, and seeing some different names would, and some more publicly recognizable names would be helpful in spurring on that growth. But people just really seem to not have a great tolerance for this particular period of dominance for some reason.
Well, this dominance that you referred to pretty well spans the last 15 years, so you know we've kind of seen it a lot, and I understand why the frustrations have been there. Let me throw two more things in here about Marco. I know I'm stuck on it here for the moment. That was the first lapsed lead of the season. I think that's interesting that he had not led a lap so far this season before last weekend's race. Another thing is that he now has twice as many wins as Graham Rahal in the IndyCar series. This is something to keep an eye on in these types of cars, I should say, over pretty much the same period of time, although Marco has more races in 06 and 07. And I had another point, but, you know, hogging all the time.
No. That's why we have you here. They listen to us all the time. So let's change the subject a little bit and talk about Takuma Sato getting his first pole of his career, first pole for a Japanese national in American open wheel racing ever, and if I'm not mistaken, first pole for KV as well. So big weekend for that team.
You were good on all of it till the pole. I believe Jimmy Vassar had one in 06.
Okay.
I got to check on that, but. I didn't remember. Maybe that was 05 even. So, Bash, take it away, and I'll do my research.
Well, I was really excited for Taku and getting his pole, especially, you know, since he'd gone through a bit with losing his father and you know, all the stuff going on in Japan. And it seemed like they keep showing on TV of one Japanese girl who's so excited about it, and she was standing there crying and jumping up and down. But then he went and crashed, like, you almost expect. It's like, wait a minute. If we could just keep them out of the wall, that would be fantastic. Because, you know, and it was Iowa last year that he also had a strong run. And then he crashed. And so it's I'd love to see him put a full race together and show what he can really do, because I think there's a lot of talent there.
He's really good at being fast in really short spurts, but it seems as if you get him going for a little bit too long and the car just gets away from him. Although, to his credit, if we didn't already have a long history of incidents with him to draw on, I think we would be just counting this as him being among the drivers that got caught out in turn two. Because there were an awful lot of them, and
the bump.
Yeah, exactly, and that's all it was. And so, if he hadn't had the pole and then gone and wrecked, and if he hadn't had all of these incidents before, I think we'd just be counting him among that handful of drivers that got caught out. But he draws a lot of attention just because of his history thus far in IndyCar and being part of the KV team that also has that reputation. And so I think we should keep that in mind when we're analyzing.
That was about the nicest thing you could have said about somebody, because he has made a lot of mistakes.
He has. It's true. It's true. But in this particular instance, I don't think that I blame him. And I've been quick to judge the entire KV team. I'll say that.
Well, Sato had his. He also had another crash on Friday during the final minutes of the final practice, which pretty clearly was his fault. So
that,
if we can't give him the second one, we'll give him the first one. one bit of information. I feel like I'm the researcher here with my book, but sometimes I bore myself with these details. but this is the third pole for KV Racing, both in Champ Car, both the prior two is in Champ Car. Vasser in 2005 and Tristan Gomedy at Mont Tremblant in 07. So I know that lineup. Even the most diehard of Champ Car fans couldn't come up with the 07 KV lineup. And Servi is the only one that most people have followed. So he ran one race for Mario Dominguez, one race. But this is it's still a rare thing for KV and a good thing for momentum as we move forward to the rest of the season.
Absolutely. And so it's more correct to say it's the first pole for KV in the merged series, then. That is absolutely true, right?
Yes.
Okay. So, go ahead, Dash.
I was just thinking that it can't hurt them at all to have had Tony Kanaan as an addition there to help try to maybe settle down some of that, you know, mistake-prone stuff. So he's got so much information to share. So I was excited to see him come along and hoping that would kind of settle things down because they are fast. Definitely, you know, Viso's been fast too in the past, but it's like a lot of mistakes come along with that speed. So it's like taking a racehorse and breaking it a little bit, and hopefully these two racehorses are getting settled down just a little.
Absolutely. That first win is coming. It's coming. It's going to come eventually, hopefully sooner than later, and that team is going to be pretty ecstatic when it finally does happen, and it'll be rightfully so. Let's talk about a topic that we sort of got started on in that discussion, and that's the bump in turn two. James Jakes got caught out there, Mike Conway and Ana Beatriz tangled there, Saavedra, Sato, and of course Will Power, who we'll talk about more detail about his race in a minute. But the debate has been raging about whether to ask the track to fix it or just to consider it part of the characteristics of the track. I'm sort of torn. On the one hand, it is nice to have each track have its unique characteristics and give drivers particular challenges that they need to learn how to sort out. They're supposed to be the best in the world, after all. But, I mean, this was also the first night race at Iowa, and I think that the colder weather, on top of the bump being more prominent than it had been in previous years, really caught a lot of people by surprise. And maybe that would be less of a factor next year. Maybe it will be just as much. And so I'm really of both minds. I don't know that there's a right answer from my perspective. What do you guys think?
Wasn't one of the drivers saying that going over that bump could actually knock your feet off the pedals?
I don't know if Darren Weldon may have said that at some point.
Yeah, and it's like at some point, if it's taking your feet completely off the pedals and it keeps getting bigger, I think at some point you have to draw the line and say, okay, this is out of hand. But I'm with you in the same way that it's like it's something to deal with. It's got to be hard, though, to deal with it when you might be in a small pack of cars and there's really nowhere to go over the right part of the bump so that it doesn't send you into the wall. And, there's a randomness about it in a way that's almost like somebody standing over the track with a big button that says, okay, now you're going to crash. And I was sort of like, I don't like that part of it, but I do like the fact that there's something of interest out there. It's not just this bull, although the bull seems to be producing some really interesting racing. That's just a little bit different. It's like, okay, mind you, there's a bit of drama over there. Let's watch. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. I'm with you on that.
Yeah.
I'd like to leave the bump. Now, I do think there could be a point of which it is a dangerous situation, but in the winter, in the Midwest, you're going to have places where tracks become a little bit different with their characteristic from year to year. Remember, we have heard about this bump in the past, but it was more prominent this year. I might also point out that all of the drivers involved are of the lesser experience on oval tracks, even Will Power. And I'm not sure Power would have had that problem had he had a properly handling race car.
Yeah.
He already had a damaged race car, and everybody else that crashed, it wouldn't have surprised you if they'd have crashed in turn three. Jakes, Beatrice, Saavedra, there's three, and Sato was the fourth. I mean, mm-hmm. do any of those surprise you if I'd have told you they crashed in turn three?
No.
No,
if
you're
I'm
right.
honest. No, it's true.
Good point.
Yeah. And I guess that sort of speaks to the fact that it's a characteristic in the track that the better drivers will figure out how to deal with it and will rise to the top, right? So.
Yeah, that's how I look at it. And even Indianapolis, which is supposed to be as smooth as they come, there's bumps there too. And if they just don't get discussed, perhaps it's because the track's bigger and the track, Indy spends more time trying to make things glass smooth that more so than most tracks.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's talk about Will Power and his really disastrous evening. Mm-hmm. Is this team determined to lose his championship in the pits? What is going on for the last couple of years with Team Penske?
I'm stunned. You say Penske and you do not think of these kind of incidents.
Over
and
it,
there's
over
been
it,
so
over
many
again.
Of them. Yeah. Yep. It's not Penske perfect.
No.
And I don't know if expanding to three teams is causing the issue, you know, because like we always talk about Andretti, part of their issue might be there's so many cars to look after, you know.
It might be, but you know,
growing
you never, yeah, but you never hear about Briscoe's crew making these mistakes. You never hear about Elio's crew making these mistakes. In fact, Elio's crew, I pointed this out in, I think I've made this argument in a couple of places about the fact that Will Power's team is really just not getting it together for him for putting a championship together. But if you watch Elio's team on any given weekend, they are doing pit stop drills during pack practice over and over and over and over again. And that is just that team that does it for some reason, not the other two. I don't know if it's just that Tim Cindric runs a really tight ship or what it is, but for some reason, Will's crew doesn't seem to have that level of dedication, and they're not coming together as well, and they're making mistakes. And it cost them a championship last year. If you sit down and you look at the numbers, everybody is so quick to say, you know, Will's not experienced on ovals, and that's where things screwed up. But no, if you sit down and you look at where the mistakes were made last year, they were made in the pits.
Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking of Chicagoland in specific. I was there, and I remember what happened. That, you know, he was up there doing fine on the oval, and then they put him behind in the pits again.
Yeah,
and it's just like the same story.
Just about every oval track last year, Power's crew made a mistake in the pits, and the only one that wasn't the crew's fault was Homestead. That was all Will. He just choked and lost it. But the rest of them, like I think at Indy, they had some issue with the fuel nozzle. Same thing at Kansas, I think. Kentucky, there were a couple of races where they missed on the fuel strategy, and then there was Chicago. It's getting to be too much. And I don't understand why the strongest crew members are not on the driver that's clearly the championship contender of that team.
Well, I don't know the ranking of the crew members to know that he doesn't have the best or what have you. This is the problem that came the other night. It was about the most simple of as they come. The right front tire changer, who is charged with releasing the driver, needs to know who are the couple three cars pitting in front of us. Now, you know, he's in an unusual spot, Power is, in this particular race, where he's starting so far back, or he is in pit road with some people who he's not accustomed to pitting with. That's all the more reason why the right front tire changer has to know that Kimball is, and a couple others are pitted in front of him, so when they look up and see him coming down the lane, whether he's in the outside lane or the inside lane, it shouldn't really matter. That Kimball car is pretty recognizable. You have to know that that's one of the cars that's going to be crossing in front of you. You're a leader, as Will was, or among the leaders. That car is going to come in behind you, and as you release, there's going to be a crossing point, which is one of the reasons why IndyCar has typically not had not deviated from how they have the fast guys up at the front and the slow cars in the back, because they don't want them crossing too often on pit lane. I mean, sometimes it's going to happen, but you try not to have cars coming in and going out at the same time next to each other or within close proximity. The fact that that he didn't recognize Kimball's car is inexcusable and is of the most basic fundamental responsibilities of that tire changer.
Yeah, I think that just about sums it up. So it'll be interesting to see where things land at the end of the year and count this among another one of the races that Will Power can point back toward if he finds himself outside the championship again. Let's talk about Scott Dixon. He had a really up-and-down weekend, qualifying 23rd and then driving up to third place in the race. He's really not having what I think at this point in his career we can call a typical season. He hasn't had a win yet. He and the team collectively have had some really rough qualifying runs in particular. I guess, to put it bluntly, what's going on?
Has he been hanging out with the Andretti folks? Sorry. No, Ray, I'm surprised. It's like, but he had a great, he's being TK this season, you know, driving up from the back and did a great job with that. But, you know, you certainly don't expect him to start back there. That was an unusual thing. And I think he said something about he kind of made a mistake on the lap, wasn't it? That cost him
so much
time. Yeah, not good.
They had both put, both the red and white cars had put a lot of downforce in the car and gambled on how the track was going to be, the conditions were going to be. And Dario said, I almost crashed as well, and I had adjusted because he went after Dixon in the qualifying line. So that really saved Dario, or it might have been, had they gone in a different order, it might have been Dario starting in the back. When you talked about the qualifying struggles that Dixon's had, maybe it's because their standards are so good, but it doesn't seem, the numbers don't reflect really poor efforts. He has not won a pole. He was second in Indianapolis and four third place starting positions. He didn't make the fast six at Long Beach, started eighth, and he qualified on his own seventh at Texas. I think we're skewed by the fact he drew the 18 spot in the second race at Texas and then this mistake here. He hasn't, I think what's surprising is he hasn't led as many laps, as what you would expect. If you throw out the 73, you probably don't have the numbers in front of you, so I'm going to give you both a chance to guess. Throughout the 73 that he led at Indy, which are obviously very, very important, how many laps do you think he's led this season?
20?
I can't think of when he's led any other laps at all.
He's led 3 laps this season outside of Indianapolis.
Wow.
One each at Texas, in both Texas races, so he led 2 at Texas and 1 at Long Beach, and my guess is because he started 8th at Long Beach, that lap came in pit cycle.
Yeah.
There wasn't hardly any.
I think all 3 of them probably did.
There probably weren't a lot of, I'll look that up here on the next break.
That's, yeah.
Can we just chalk it up to being more competitive field, being in a more competitive field? Because, you know, it seems like other people are qualifying up, you know, Newman Haas is qualifying stronger and racing stronger, you know, other people like that.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know what the answer is because, I mean, you certainly don't want to think of Scott Dixon as being a driver who whose talent gets away from him. And he's with one of the top teams. So that's, I mean, other than the couple of hiccups that they've had in terms of some qualifying and concerns.
Field strategy.
Yeah. really, it's hard to put your finger on it other than the fact that he's really being outshone by Dario all of a sudden.
Well, I think that's just it. Dario has made everybody kind of look bad. Except for Power, and the 2 laps he led at Texas were both in pit cycle. The lap at Long Beach appears to be that, but I can't tell from, there were so many people who led 1 laps or a couple laps here or there, and the track is a street circuit. It's a little difficult to read the box score there, but my guess is you're right. All three of those laps came in pit cycles, which is amazing for Scott Dixon. Again, he did lead the most laps at Indianapolis, I believe. Surely 73 was the most anybody led at Indy, but which is pretty impressive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he led a race high 73 laps, five different occasions. So he was obviously hooked up at Indy, but nowhere else.
No. Okay, let's talk one last topic about Iowa, and that's the fact that there's been discussion that this race might become a doubleheader next year. There seem to be some really conflicting opinions out there on whether this is a good idea. My take on this one is if Oval fans want an even schedule with the same number of Oval races as road races, I don't really know what they think they can ask of IndyCar. There are not that many oval tracks out there that want to play ball right now. So when you get one at a place like Iowa where the fans are really dedicated and it puts on really great racing, I think that a doubleheader is a perfectly reasonable idea, particularly if you do one as a night race and one as an afternoon race the next day. I think that could be hard on the teams if somebody totals a car on Saturday night and they have to scramble to put together the backup. But it would definitely make it interesting in terms of watching the performance in the different conditions. And it's a better solution, I think, for particularly small markets where you don't want to overstress the income potential of the smaller areas such as that. I think it's a better solution than trying to do two separate weekends, because that's asking an awful lot of a crowd like the Iowa crowd, I think.
I'm going to agree with that. Definitely a doubleheader in the same weekend.
I'm inclined to allow, like I have a lot to say about that. But my preference would be, I'm okay with doing it once. I would not want to do it multiple venues so that it's a special event.
Yeah.
So people have a sense in Iowa that they're getting to see something no one else is getting to see.
Mm-hmm. Right.
My fear, though, is let me give you a little background. Randy Bernard, he floated this idea of a doubleheader at Iowa by going to several people in the media and saying, between us, what do you think?
Mm-hmm.
And continued to basically float this to everybody, and so everybody felt like they had a story. And so he's pretty much throwing it up against the wall to see if it sticks. Here's his problem. As I look at the calendar right now, he's got four tracks that he can count on for oval track races next year: Indianapolis, Iowa, Kentucky, and Vegas. You can't at this point count on New Hampshire. You've not seen the crowd. You've not seen, I mean, it was abysmal the last couple times that IndyCars were in New Hampshire, and it's always been a place wherever IndyCar has raced where they had Champ Car cart previously, it's not done well. So there are four tracks that you can count on for next year that are ovals.
Sorry to interrupt you, Kurt. I think you have to say five. You didn't conclude Texas in your count there.
Texas might not be.
Really?
Yeah.
You can't count on Texas right now.
Why would you say that? I'm surprised to hear that.
Because there's real conflict with Eddie Gossage said on our Trackside show a couple weeks ago that if IndyCar goes to Houston, you can forget us.
Oh,
now, is he playing hardball?
I'm sorry to admit that I missed that.
You know, is he just bluffing and blowing smoke? He might be, and they might be able to work something out. But there's also the issue of pit exit, of a bump that the IndyCar drivers desperately want fixed. They say that area is too rough. Talk about getting, I think Dario was the one that said you were a couple of feet off the ground coming out of the pit road. So there are some issues with Texas, and I can't put it in the category of for sures yet. Now, the betting person in me would say they're going to return there, but it's no sure thing.
Hmm.
And same thing with New Hampshire. But Chicagoland looks like it could come into play in California. If all those come into play, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's eight tracks. You know you're going to have at least 10 road or street circuits, so you really do need to pick up at least one more. And if you do Iowa's a doubleheader one time, do it in 2012, I think it would fly. If you do it as a regular thing, I'm not as interested.
Hmm. Yeah, I think that that's reasonable. I think the ultimate goal is to get an even number of races with an individual track in each spot. But as a holdover, I definitely think this is a fair solution. Okay, let's talk about a couple of other topics just quickly. There was some comments made. I don't know if either of you have even seen this yet, but Randy Bernard was in Toronto today talking to some of the media to build up some excitement for the race in a couple of weeks. And Norris McDonald of the Star got a comment out of Randy where he said that he would, quote, quit on the spot if Vegas doesn't pull good ratings. And he went on to take examples of the fact that Homestead pulled a 0.3 on versus last year, and he mentioned, I think, yeah, Milwaukee came up with the 0.8 on ABC, and he said if Vegas doesn't get bigger numbers than that, then he's going to walk away, or he could have been blustering. I think he probably was blustering, but
I hope so.
Yeah, I kind of panicked a little bit when I saw the quote as well. But that, that was my initial reaction, was to say that I do think that he's blustering and trying to draw more, even more attention to the Vegas race, but I certainly hope that that's not the thing that makes him walk away. Kurt, thoughts?
Well, he better wait to see if the Eagles and the Cowboys are playing at 4 o'clock on CBS, because these things aren't dictated by how good your product is. We've seen that time and again. It has much more to do with the competition on the other channels, and I would like to see him do well, but there is no guarantee, no matter how much he blusters.
Absolutely.
And there's going to be definitely sports fatigue at that time, because not only is football started, but the World Series and the playoffs, baseball playoffs, will be going on. You know, he has a better chance since it'll be an ABC race of it being better, but again, you never know what it's going up against at this point.
And we still don't know who the five drivers are that are being brought in for it, and that's going to be pivotal for seeing how much success we can expect that race to see. So a lot of what ifs and maybes still outstanding on that one. The announcements, we didn't have a podcast last week, so I think this happened actually before that would have been, but the announcement came out that Brian Herta Autosport and Dan Weldon will be doing the testing of the 2012 car. What a great deal for them. Everybody keeps saying that, you know, Dan is in a great position on the test team. Great to see him in the Versus booth, which we'll touch on in a second. Certainly he should be in a car, but in the absence of that, he seems to be doing pretty well for himself and getting that team extremely well set up to look at having a full-time program in 2012. And you have to believe that it would be an excellent program considering the way that things played out in Indianapolis. So it will be very interesting to see how that plays out. Any thoughts on that?
I asked him today if it was more important to have the Indy 500 on his resume for 2012 or the test driver, because he's going to get a lot of miles on a new car in various conditions on different tracks. I think that's going to be a huge help to his signability for 2012.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I know a lot of people are saying, well, that's not fair for that team, but I do understand they have to share all the data. But for the driver itself, that experience cannot be transmitted. So definitely puts him in a great spot.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's talk quickly about the Versus broadcast. We keep saying that the Versus broadcasts are not pulling in very good ratings. The last the broadcast for Iowa pulled in a 0.35, which is not great, but not bad. It's an improvement, a 35% improvement over last year, in fact. So it's good to see that slowly trending upward, but I have to say that your co-host on Trackside, particularly Kurt, Kevin Lee, and the rest of the team have really started to get things going well this season. And having Dan Weldon in there, as we keep saying, is an excellent addition. And I was really partial to the grid walk. I think it needs a bit of tweaking, but I thought that was an excellent feature, and I hope that they keep it going forward.
I'm going to have to defer to the two of you, as I don't normally get to see the broadcast, and I do tape them, but I tend to find myself rushing through to the key points that I remember so that I can look at moves and passes and so forth. But it's you know, I think Weldon's done a great job from what I've heard, and as long as he continues to do, he's going to have to do more homework, because he probably has, as you move through the tracks and the times that he has on the air, he's going to go through his bit of information that he can speak to. He's going to need to talk to the drivers and see what trends and things are going on in their respective situations, rather than just relaying what he knows about his experience.
Dash?
I think he probably knows those drivers well enough to do that, so hopefully he'll pick up on that. But I do think he's been a great addition. He's just a natural at expressing, you know, things that other folks don't think of because they haven't been in the thick of it with these drivers and these cars at these tracks. And I think he's he brings a lot of energy to it. I agree about the gridwalk as well. It was a little bit bumpy, you know, sometimes they were talking over each other a little, and so I think just a little bit of practice on that, but it was a lot of fun, and it's an opportunity for, you know, the personalities to come out, because everybody wants to give both Robin Miller and Dan Weldon a hard time whenever they get a chance, and they're both pretty good at dishing it back. So that's where you get to see a little bit more of the energy of the interplay between the participants, which you don't always get a piece of when they're in the car, unless you're listening to the radio.
Yeah.
And that's when you get to bleep them out, because they're swearing about what that guy just did next to me. So, you know, this is a fun way to show them off, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And my one comment about the gridwalk would be just, I understand what they were trying to do with the rapid fire concept, but they could slow it down just a touch, and they would still achieve that, and they wouldn't be stepping on each other as much. So
that's
my thought on that. But definitely an excellent feature that that is worth working on going forward. Okay, one last topic, and this is going into lights. So I don't know, Kurt, how much you've been keeping an eye on this one, but we got the news today that the O2 Racing Technology team and Mark Olson have been suspended and had their hard cards pulled for the not only the remainder of the 2011 season, but also the entire 2012 season because of their actions at Milwaukee. There's a lot to this story that's not coming out, I'm sure of it. The story pieced together from bits and pieces heard here and there is essentially that Sam Schmidt Motorsports at Milwaukee, this is the lights teams, were issued some penalties. The penalties were rescinded. The story that I heard was that that happened because the quote-unquote infractions were not technically rule infractions so much as suggestions that had been made. Mark Olson and the team got upset about that, and they allegedly, according to IndyCar, not allegedly, since this was the reasoning behind the suspension, tried to encourage the other teams not to participate in the event. And so what led, and eventually the O2 team did pull out, but they were the only team that did. And so that is what led to the suspension here. And some comments have sort of started trickling out from the O2 team saying that what IndyCar is alleging is not true, that they never tried to do that. So there's a lot going on with this story that we'll definitely have to keep an eye on. It's almost even difficult to fully comment on it because there are so many different sides to the story that are sort of making their way out in fits and spurts, and it's hard to put it all together. Kurt, what do you know?
Well, I talked to Mark Olson for about 45 minutes today, and I actually have more on this in Friday's Pit Pass in the Indianapolis Star, and I'm not using that as a ploy to get people to read that. I just haven't gone through all the notes yet. When you talk to somebody for 45 minutes and they're as passionate about what happened as Mark is, then you understand that there's a lot of things to go through. Mm-hmm. But essentially this problem dated back to the Indianapolis 500 and two cars, both Sam Schmidt Motorsports being involved, and then what happened with an owner's meeting in Milwaukee kind of escalated the problem. He insists that at no point did he try to encourage others to withdraw. He also said that, and really the thrust of what he's disappointed in, and and quite frankly, I am as well, is that IndyCar has had a history, or at least a policy, if not even just a practice, of not identifying those who break the rules. Mm-hmm. It's very much a closed bit of information. And my contention is that NASCAR has made a living in the press of announcing fines, having them argue back and forth. They get 2 or 3 days of the news cycle to fight over who's right and who's wrong and how many points they're going to lose, and that's part of the story. And if anything, it keeps, you know, when you're I don't want to call it cheating yet, but when you have done something outside of the rules and you're identified, then you tend to fall back in line quicker. And so that's the issue that that Mark faces, and the troublesome when he found out that I think as many as 10, I believe was the number. I have to go back in my notes and look. There have been 10 infractions in Indy Lights this season. Not one had come to light. And
wow.
And so he'd like those listed. And I believe that's what IndyCar needs as a whole. And I've been saying that for better than 10 years now, that they need to identify which teams are crossing the line.
Well, and they did actually issue a press release. I think it was late last week. It was one of their news and notes where they've just got 4 or 5 little short stories that they put out there for the press. And one of the stories in there was actually a story about a technical infraction in the Light Series by one of the Sam Schmidt cars.
And they lost 10 points. And the only other time I can remember, maybe others can come to your minds, the only other time I remember IndyCar identifying a rules infraction was Scott Sharp's car, and that had to be a full 10 years ago. They wouldn't talk about the fine, but technical inspection needs to be very transparent.
Yes, and I think my point was that seems to be maybe the start of where things are starting to go. And I know that Randy Menard, for a fact, I personally, and I've seen other conversations, I've spoken with him about this, and he's very aware that communication from the series to the media and the fans is poor. And so I think he's one of the people that's pushing for this. And so I guess what I was trying to say was, with this one reveal of an infraction, I think they hired, forgive me, I forget his name.
Will Phillips?
Yes, to refine and revise the process for next year, and I think that that's part of the story as well, is it not? For them trying to make this process more transparent.
Yeah, that's a goal, and so we'll see. We have a lot of room to grow, certainly.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it really impacts in a very negative way the credibility of the sport. When we have all this secrecy going on, and then you find people that are, you know, leaving, and there's, you know, there's the he said, she said going on right now, because, you know, Mark's saying, I didn't try to convince others to leave, but the series kicked him out for just that. And it doesn't look good. It really doesn't look good.
No, and speaking of things that don't look good, the Indy Lights field certainly didn't need to have one less car in it.
No. Yeah, that looks like the old soapbox derby that you're practicing for in your neighborhood right now. You know, it's sort of like the big race is coming up, and we just got the kids from our neighborhood coming and going, you know, maybe 10, 12 cars at the most, maybe 14. I don't think it's much higher than that. It's pretty sad. So it used to be a bit larger fields, but lately they've been so small, and losing another team is just, it's tough.
It should be a larger field as we move back to the street and road circuits. There are a lot of people just didn't want to tear up equipment at the ovals, and I don't blame them for that. If they don't have an experienced driver, they don't have a lot of extra equipment, funding's not in great shape. I think the numbers will be better on as we move to Toronto and Edmonton.
It's funny, how of the four now established rungs on the road to Indy ladder, the Lights seems to be the weakest link. I mean, Star Mazda came into the ladder as a very strong and well-established series with excellent fields. But USF 2000 seems to have relaunched itself fairly strongly. It's just lights. It seems to, especially in the past couple of years, not be as strong. And I mean, last year's field was small but talented, and it was a lot of fun to watch. But the majority of the really talented drivers, with the exception of J.K. Vernay, who has vanished into the ether, unfortunately, the rest of the big talent in that field has really moved up. And the I think that one of the problems with lights right now is that, with the possible exception of Joseph Newgarden, nobody really knows who any of these kids are. So it's a small field with not a lot of interest being drawn to it, which is the start of an unfortunate downward spiral.
Yeah, I have to say, I don't know the history of a lot of the new drivers as well as I probably should. It's kind of hard to keep up with on all. But not a lot of them came from Star Mazda, right? They've come from other series, maybe in Europe.
Yeah.
So I think we just haven't made that full connection from the four, you know, feeding directly into each other. So, and maybe when the Star Mazda kids are ready to move up, that'll help a little bit. But I think we've just had a big influx of people coming from other places, and it's like, I don't know how to say their name,
yeah.
You know? So, yeah, it might take a little time to see that, but it's kind of sad to see such light fields.
And when you say that, I should also point out that Connor Daly is going to be back. Is he back in Toronto? Or is that one of the ones that he's missing?
I think he's missing Atlanta. Isn't it? They're doing Three Rivers in August. I think he's back for that one.
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
So he's not even back yet to draw a little bit more attention to the field. So we'll
have
to
beat everybody.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, those are all the topics that I have for tonight, unless anything occurs to either of you that we haven't discussed that we should.
Kurt, is there something we should know about tomorrow night's show? Have you got any breaking news lined up?
I probably will make up something, but most of it was divulged tonight, so you can count on that. And
Well, news always breaks on Thursdays just in time for Trackside, so I'm sure there will be
something new
to discuss. Yes, yeah, I'm sure there will be something new to discuss, absolutely.
We do have Dan Weldon on the show tomorrow. I was trying to remember who else, but I know Dan Weldon, so
okay.
That's one good name.
Yeah, absolutely. Great. Well, Kurt, thank you for joining us once again. We just certainly appreciate your insight, and Bash, thank you for taking
absolutely.
The time to speak with us as well. So thanks to all of you at home for listening, and we'll be back next week to do a little bit of a preview of my home race of Toronto. So we're definitely looking forward to that. And remember that morefrontwing.com is your source online for blogs, photos, podcasts, and more covering the IZOD IndyCar Series and beyond.